Welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, the latest on shares, markets and investments, now available on your Amazon Alexa.
Hello and welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, now also available on the UK Investor Magazine mobile app. For today's podcast, we're going to be taking a deep dive into European equities. We're going to be looking at the key themes out there which are driving European stocks, as well as looking at a number of individual names. And to do that, we're very kindly joined once more by Michael Field, who is the European market strategist at Morningstar. We spoke on the podcast previously, I think it was towards the beginning of this year, a very insightful podcast. So, Michael, very much welcoming you back today.
Appreciate the warm welcome, Jonathan. Great to be back speaking with you again.
As I said, we're going to be looking at the macro environment in Europe for equities, and then we're going to move on and we're going to be discussing some individual names as well as sectors. Before we get into it, Michael, please would you be able to give us an introduction for those that don't already know to yourself as well as Morningstar, please?
Yep. So Morningstar, we're a kind of a US financial services firm. We're across everything from fund ratings, mutual fund ratings, which is kind of the better known part of the business, and then all the way to equity research, which is the area that I work in. So I operate out of Europe. We're actually based in Amsterdam. We have about kind of 15, closer to 20 analyst team here now looking at European equities. And I've got the great pleasure of being the European market strategist. So I get the interesting job of looking across our entire equity research universe and kind of finding the interesting things to talk to you about.
Indeed. And we're going to be picking up on some of those interesting things a little bit later on, particularly as far as individual equities. But we're going to start off, Michael, and look at the bigger picture here. And it's quite a broad point that I think I'd like to start with now. And it's, you know, when you look at Europe and European equities as a whole, what are the big factors for you at the moment? What are the biggest risks? Where do you see the rewards out there at the moment?
Yeah. So I think, look, the first thing to say is that there's been times in Europe where equities have been cheaper, certainly. And it's been a case where, you know, it's just an outright buy. You don't really have to think much about it, that the rewards far outweigh the risks. And we're at a different place right now. So, you know, equity markets have rallied, you know, toward the end of last year and into this year. So the gains have been pretty good for those investors. And we're now at a point, using our bottom-up intrinsic fair value analysis, to say that equities in Europe are fairly valued. So they're not cheap, but they're not expensive either. So that's the kind of first thing to say. From a kind of a macroeconomic perspective, we're entering a totally different phase, or we have done in the last couple of months. So we've gone through this period where inflation was, you know, almost at double digit levels across the UK and Europe, and that's settled down, thankfully. Interest rates were, you know, at 16, 17 year highs, and we're starting to see them coming down. So the ECB cut rates last month, the Bank of England looks set to cut them next month. So that's good news from that perspective as well. And the economies of the UK and Europe, which were, you know, very much weak last year, we almost, you know, we were kind of fighting our way through recession, essentially, they're starting to improve as well off a low base. So the macro picture is looking better, but equities are kind of fairly valued. But if you weighed that up versus where we were 6 or 9 months ago, I would say we're in a better position. And the overall proposition then for equities is looking quite attractive.
There are, of course, a number of sectors that you've highlighted as offering better value than the rest of the market. And we're going to touch on those a bit later on in the podcast. But there's another point here, and it's more from a macro perspective on the politics of Europe, because, of course, just last week we had the UK elections and French elections earlier on this year, earlier on this week. And there was, at some point, particularly in France, the risk of the far right taking power. It didn't transpire. There was a surprise reaction from the French voters actually there. But there is this question about the far right, Michael, and it's not just in France. There's signs of it across Europe. And of course, when we did get those snap elections and early results that showed the rise of the far right. There was huge volatility out there in European equities. I remember looking at the CAC just a couple of weeks ago, big sell-offs there. So I think that's worth touching on. And the question is really, is it the fear of the far right coming into power and their policies in terms of the risk for European equities, or is it more the uncertainty about what they could do? And, you know, looking at what's happening in the last couple of weeks, is that a sign of things to come possibly?
So I think, you know, you said kind of the beginning of the year instead of the beginning of the week, but it does feel like things are moving very, very quickly at the moment. So we had written some analysis last week about Rassemblement National and what they were likely to do with France and how French equities were likely to react to that. And then we quickly had to rewrite everything at the beginning or at the weekend, the beginning of this week even as well, you know, with the election changing course completely. And if you think, okay, there's two things here. Ultimately, there's the risk of far right parties getting in to Europe. I think we've already seen that, you know, previously with Italy, then the Netherlands, closer to home for us, and now in France. And look, ultimately, it didn't prove true this time in France. But, you know, Marine Le Pen came out straight after the election and said, look, you've just delayed the inevitable, that the underlying issues that cause people to vote in that direction haven't changed and are probably unlikely to change materially over the next year or two. So that danger from the far right parties is still very much there. Obviously, we're kind of apolitical from that perspective, but when you look at the policies that they were talking about enacting, they could prove very damaging for economies, and in particular France, which is already running a budget deficit that the European Union are saying, okay, you got to tighten that, not blow it out further, because that could totally affect credit spreads and funding costs for banks and things like this. So there's a lot of damage the far right parties could bring in, which is one reason why people are fearful of those parties from an investment perspective. But you made the point as well to say that the uncertainty is also what people don't like. And this is very true also. So I think, look, in France, the equities, which initially fell when the election was first announced, have more or less rallied back to where they were. But there's still some fears in certain sectors of the economy. Banks, for instance, is that example I used again. But, you know, our banking team are talking about some of the policies that the far left are looking to introduce and the uncertainty that they bring as well. So it's not like we're out of the woods yet just because the far right party hasn't got into power. There's still that uncertainty that you mentioned. And I think it's a good intro into the UK as well, because if there's one thing the UK has now in terms of an advantage perhaps over the rest of Europe, it's that kind of certainty that at least from an investment perspective, companies are familiar with the Labour Party, their manifesto, and they know what to expect over the next few years, and they can kind of make their investment decisions accordingly.
And we're actually going to touch a little bit later on the podcast in some of the sectors that may see a boost on the back of the Labour government. But we're going to just move on now, if you may, Michael, and look at a couple of sectors within European equities that Morningstar have picked out as offering good value. And they were and are the utility sector and consumer sector. And that's obviously looking at comparisons to other sectors out there. But Michael, what do you see as the core valuation metrics there within your analysis that are making these particular sectors offer value compared to the wider market? And what do you see as a potential catalyst to get these sectors moving?
So I think, you know, the sector valuations have moved around so much since the beginning of this year. We're talking about completely different areas than we would have, you know, 6-7 months ago, which is an interesting place to be in. But, you know, specifically, if you look at those sectors that you mentioned, consumer and utilities, what's affecting them, that's affecting other sectors differently, is the macro picture. So, you know, specifically interest rates and inflation, and then to some degree, the political climate as well. So kind of dealing with those things one by one, you know, the consumer sector, both defensive and cyclicals, have been hammered over the last couple of years. Like some companies have done very well. You know, if you follow the likes of Unilever or Nestle, those kind of staples that, you know, that we all use and buy every other day, they've been kind of offering up decent pricing power. They've been managing to push through 7 or 8% annual price increases even as, you know, recently as a few months ago, while still maintaining their, you know, their revenues, which has been massively impressive. But the problem with that is that consumers, their wallets have been stretched. So if prices go up, what it means is they're just going to buy less products. And you've seen that in the UK. The British Retail Consortium released figures a few months ago saying that consumers are actually buying less goods now than they did before the pandemic 5 years ago. So that's an amazing stat and a bit worrying as well. And some of the figures that we've seen recently also have said that, you know, private label goods, specifically in those kind of commoditized areas like, you know, nappies or grains or anything like this, private label has been gaining share in those areas. And that's quite obvious that people have less money and they're buying the kind of cheaper alternative to things. So consumer goods companies definitely have their work cut out for them over the coming months, but they have some tailwinds. So inflation's been waning, which means now they don't have to keep pushing prices up, which should be good for consumers, generally speaking. And then interest rates as well, you know, lower interest rates should help as well. If consumers naturally have some more money in their pockets, their mortgage costs, all those people on tracker mortgages should start feeling the benefit, you know, in the coming months or towards the end of this year, as and when the Bank of England lower rates. So they're the kind of catalysts for the consumer sector as a whole. The utility sector then, and we could talk about this for quite some time, but the kind of short story there is, look, again, interest rates were very high. Utility companies generally have more debt than other companies. So as interest rates come down, their cost of debt servicing should come down also, which should certainly help those companies. And also from an investment perspective, you know, people had been weighing up whether to invest in utilities and take dividends, or indeed invest in bonds, which are kind of risk-free if you're buying government bonds. And then that would give you comparable income every month. But as interest rates fall, the attractiveness of those bonds decreases and the relative attractiveness of the utility sector, given the high income generated from that sector, should look more attractive. So those are the kind of catalysts that we see.
Thank you. So I just want to pick up on one name that you named in your report amongst others, but I think this will be particularly interesting for listeners of this podcast because it is a London listed stock. And it's quite interesting what you were saying there, Michael, about the people switching to private labels, because it's Reckitt Benckiser that you have picked out. And of course, you said that you see some tailwinds for that sector, but it would be quite interesting to hear your thoughts on why Reckitt Benckiser, amongst others, is in that sector.
Yeah, so I think, look, you know, Reckitt Benckiser can sometimes be overlooked as a stock relative to, you know, the Nestlés of the world or the Unilevers, which people are a bit more familiar with. But they have a pretty broad range of brands, you know, from everything from Sillit Bang, if you remember those ads from years ago, to Durex, to a whole host of other things that people use on a daily basis. So they're very much entrenched in the brands that we're familiar with and the goods that we use on a daily basis. Reckitt's have had their own trouble in recent while. There's been a few legal issues that they've been kind of getting to grips with, which have kind of put a bit of a dampener on the stock over the last while. But ultimately, our analysis is kind of showing that all of these issues are relatively contained. And if you look at the recovery of the stock revenue-wise and margin-wise, it seems to be getting back to where it was before. So I think there's a number of overhangs, possibly, you know, keeping the stock down, as well as the general conditions that we mentioned that are affecting the entire consumer defensive industry. So I think the problem is that people might look at this and think that it's one of the weaker consumer branded stocks, but indeed it's still a moaty name, as our analysis points out. And now is the kind of time to be getting in on a stock with such a large discount, I would say.
Thank you. So just one point also on the utilities, and you did go into it in some detail, but it is looking at the shift in interest rates that we could see later on this year, and of course the relative attraction to these types of equities to bonds. Is that the biggest story, Michael, or is there, you know, operational attractions when you're looking at the utility sectors? And you know, utility sectors, again, has its subsectors. Are there any subsectors in there which are a little bit more interesting than others?
So yeah, indeed. Look, there's lots to talk about from the utility sector and attractiveness. Those were just kind of two of the things that we rose at the kind of rose at the beginning. But no, indeed. Look, I think one thing about the utility sector as well is it's been massively influenced by power prices, particularly those utility companies that are in the business of power generation in Europe. So that's been kind of volatile, and lower power prices, which we've benefited from at the end of last year and into this year, have hurt some of those utility companies as well, which has ultimately created some opportunities. But structurally, you know, the likes of RWE and companies like this and Veolia are very much involved in the renewable segment, which is obviously kind of a structural growth story. And that kind of ties back into what we were talking earlier about as well with the new Labour government in the UK. One of the policies that they're trying to improve upon from the Conservative government is the kind of speeding up of the decarbonisation of the grid in the UK. And they're trying to complete that by 2030, which is a really ambitious target. But what it means is that there's going to be increased focus and increased kind of allowances for a lot of these renewables-based companies to try to get them to meet the demand that is going to be laid out before them. Which could be a huge boost for these companies as well. So there's plenty of catalysts for the utility sector.
So you touched on the renewables sector there, Michael, and that leads nicely on to the next point. And of course, it's Labour coming into power here in the UK. When you're looking at the renewables sector now and the UK sector compared to the rest of Europe, in your view, where does it sit? Does it make it a little bit more attractive than the rest of Europe? I mean, was it already attractive? How does that potential shift in policy change the attractiveness of the equities here in the UK, which are operating in that sector?
I think it comes back to that point, you know, we spoke about a little while ago in terms of stability, right? And visibility also. I think ultimately the targets around, you know, renewables and moving to renewables are generally quite broad based, right? They're not hugely different in the UK than they are in the Eurozone. But I think the difference now in the UK is if indeed there's a Labour government for the next 4, possibly even 8 years, you have that clear line of sight as to what the policies are going to be. And utility companies and renewables companies can then look at that and really commit capital on the back of that in the knowledge that they will get those promised returns, that things aren't going to change. Do I think that's a huge issue in Europe at the moment? Not really, but there is still that element of uncertainty around governments in different regions. And we've seen in the Netherlands, for instance, kind of backlash against green parties, and in Germany as well. So it's not to say that renewable targets aren't the way that we're all going anyway, but there could be some differences in, you know, when they actually plan to meet those targets by. And that's an advantage that the UK has over other regions at the moment, I would say.
So one of the other sectors that's been seen as a potential beneficiary of the Labour government and a shift in policy is, of course, the house building sector. And we spoke, Michael, I think it was Q4 possibly last year. And one of the stocks that was picked out in your report at that point was Persimmon. Embarked on a huge rally since, probably up 50-60% since that point. But it'd be interesting to get your views on the UK house building sector now after that rally, and of course with the change in government and what that means going forward.
So, you know, you're completely right. Yeah, the shares are up like from the lows. I think the last time we spoke, they're up about 50%, which sounds amazing. And you would kind of naturally assume from that that we've kind of completed the journey and we're back to where we should be. But it's not the case. So we'll still see kind of, 60 plus percent upside to a lot of the house builder names. And that's only getting them back to where they were back in, you know, 21, 22. So that'll kind of illustrate the magnitude of the fall that they've been through. So if, you know, from that you can gather we're very keen on the house building segment as a whole. We've been banging the drum about this for, you know, at least 6 months now. The naysayers might kind of raise the point that, okay, this is a really cyclical stocks. They're very much in the trenches, and there's a long recovery period on this. But history has shown that cyclically, the likes of banks and home builders recover quite quickly, and they recover, their share prices recover long before the cycle actually reaches its kind of high point. So that's one point on them. In terms of the catalysts and the Labour government and things like this, yes, indeed. So that's one of the main, you know, promises by the Labour government, that they're looking to execute on 300,000 new build homes every year for the next 5 years, which would put us back to the levels of building, you know, that we haven't seen since the 1970s. So that will kind of show you the ambition that they have there. Whether or not they hit that is another story. But as the saying goes, you know, if you reach for the moon, you know, you might reach the sky. So I think for home builders, this is kind of just the catalyst that they need. And then if you combine that with the potential fall in interest rates as well across the UK, that should help mortgage applications and housing demand naturally. So I think we've always spoken about the long-term catalyst for home builders, you know, population growth, etc. But now you have two more shorter-term catalysts to hopefully keep those share prices moving in the right direction.
Thank you. So final point here is quite a broad question, Michael, and it's looking at Europe versus the United States. And of course, there's been for some time now a significant premium on US stocks compared to European ones. Is there a scenario that you see Europe catching up with the US, or is this just a concept that's completely for the birds?
So I suppose it depends on the definition of, you know, what it means to be catching up, right? Are we going to suddenly come up with kind of a world-beating tech segment and stocks that can rival Nvidia, now the biggest company in the world? No, that's not going to happen anytime soon at all. Our tech segment pales in comparison to what you have in the US. But, you know, are we going to catch up in terms of economic growth or attractiveness to the region? I think that's a possibility. So, you know, if you take those things in kind of isolation, look, economic growth last year, GDP in the US was 2.5%, and, you know, it was close to 0.5% in the UK and Europe last year. So we're really struggling from that perspective. But if you think about how things stand today, interest rates look to be cut sooner rather than later in the UK. They've already been cut in Europe. There's two more rate cuts priced in before the year end. So actually, we should have lower interest rates in the Eurozone than either the US or the UK all the way out to 2026. So that should confer on us some kind of advantage and some kind of catalyst for GDP growth as well, which is certainly a positive. And then if you look on top of that, valuation wise, we're looking more cheap in Europe at the moment. I mentioned that our markets are fairly valued, but the US is about 10% overvalued on a market cap weighted basis. So from an investment perspective, it's already looking quite attractive there. And then the kind of final point, and one that's a bit overlooked by people, is that, like, the US, the economic growth there, it is a miracle. You know, people were worried about recession in the US, and it grew to this degree it did last year and the year before. But a lot of that is fueled by debt, you know, post-COVID, Bidenomics. So they've been pumping money into the economy as a result. And ultimately, at some point, they're going to have to deal with the debt burden that they've created, which isn't something that's happened in Europe or the UK. So we do have an advantage there that we haven't really burdened ourselves with debt, and our economies look already to be improving. So it's not all bad news.
Thank you. As always, fascinating, Michael. And for people listening to this would like to know a little bit more about some of the themes that we've discussed today, do check out the notes to this podcast, because there'll be a link through to Morningstar's Q3 outlook for European stocks. And a lot of the themes that we touched on today will be covered in more detail there. So, Michael, thank you for being on the podcast today.
Thank you, Jonathan.
And thank you very much to everyone for listening. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the UK Investor Magazine podcast. Please do share the podcast, and we really value any reviews and comments you leave us in your chosen podcast player. The views presented by the hosts and guests of the UK Investor Magazine podcast are in no way investment advice, and please remember, all investment involves risk.